It is time to get started on our next session, Built Environment, Building for Circularity. And contributing to around 9% of Australia's GDP, the architecture, engineering, construction industries offer amazing opportunities to adopt circular business models and reduce much of the materials going to landfill every year. And as we heard yesterday from the Planet Ark report on how business are implementing circular practices, the built environment sector respondents were significantly more likely to nominate circular economy as important. So we know they're well onto it. Examples from Europe provide a clear depiction of how policy, design, investment and collaboration can create long-term benefits, and this session will be highlighting both local and overseas examples, showcasing implementation across the built environment and looking at buildings and infrastructure. As with many of these, there's another opportunity for Q&A, so please remember to use the Q&A function in the Circularity app for this. First up in our session, we are very pleased to have an opening keynote from Valentina Petroni. And Valentina is WSP's Circular Economy Lead in Australia and New Zealand. And among Valentina's recent work was leading the development of the New South Wales Government Circular Design Guidelines for the Built Environment. So please put your hands together to welcome Valentina.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for inviting me to presenting on the work we're doing on circular design for the built environment. Today I have the pleasure to share the work I've been doing and demonstrating what a circular economy approach in design means in practice. As I was introduced, I work for WSP. I'm the circular economy lead across Australia and New Zealand, and I'm part of an amazing team of 13 people across Australia and New Zealand, and we work across property and buildings, mining, infrastructure, roads and water projects. And my focus area, being an architect by background, is really to embed a circular economy approach into design from the very early stages. And today I will share some of the true stories behind the scenes, so what are the main challenges and the main outcomes and benefits and results. But before I start, I would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians on the land where we are here today. And at WSP, we acknowledge that every project we work on takes place on the First People land. And that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are the first scientists and engineers, and we pay our respect to the elders past, present, and future. I'm really pleased that this year's topic for the conference is to look into what is circularity in practice, so going beyond the principles. I've left the principles on the slides and a little reference on what is a circular economy approach, but I really wanted to focus on what does a circular economy approach for the built environment means. And it's not easy at all, so with our team, we're trying to prepare this figure that really summarizes what we want to avoid, which is a conventional design approach. So if you look at the black icons and black arrows, really looking at a business-as-usual approach where we extract materials, manufacture into the products we need, and we design our assets using conventional design strategies. And unfortunately, typically, after an asset reaches the end of their useful life or service life, it is demolished and the materials are either downcycled or sent to landfill. We really want to challenge this approach and looking at circular design opportunities. So if we look in a nutshell at the red icons and red arrows, really by implementing a circular design approach, looking at design for longevity, design for disassembly, design for durability and the future deconstruction, how do we really shift the approach? And I will dive into that a bit more with practical examples, but really we want to challenge the status quo, and ideally the end of service of an asset might become the starting point of a new project. There have been lots of talking with respect to what is the importance of a circular economy and the link on to net zero, so I won't spend too much time on this slide. I think everybody is now familiar with this diagram. What I really would like to point out is that we are hearing a lot from Europe that the reduction and minimization of Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, mainly related to thanks to the use of renewable energies and electrification of our assets, will become at some point the new norm. And the next challenge will be looking how we minimize scope 3 emissions and looking at embodied carbon, but not just that, also looking at reducing the amount of construction and demolition waste we produce in the first place. There are strong links with the fit-out waste and the food waste. And really, if there is one thing we can take out from my contribution today is really how can we shift from considering waste as something to be get rid of very quickly into an opportunity and as a resource. How we do that, as I mentioned at the beginning, is not simple in the built environment. We really need a systemic shift like we have heard across those 2 days during the conference, starting from governance and policy, definitely very important, but also changing the way we design our assets and we manage our assets. So an holistic design approach across all project stages and different stakeholders is very important. As was mentioned at the beginning, I had the honor to co-author the circular design guidelines for the New South Wales state government, the first type of this policy in Australia, which is a great first step into looking at the framework of circular design strategies and understanding how across design, procurement, construction, operation, and end of service, we really need to have a different approach. In terms of projects, I had the pleasure to be working within WSP on a variety of projects across infrastructure, master planning, building design, and fit-out projects and material selections. Today, I would love to share 3 examples that I'm really happy to have contributed to. The first one is the Bradfield City Centre in the Western Sydney. Finally, I can talk about it because it's been a confidential project for over a year. And the contribution we had was to define a circular economy strategy to propose a master planning for the first circular city in Australia. And from a strategic point of view, very important was the foundation on that waste is not a problem, is a resource, how we can make the most of it, and looking at the opportunities to embed the circular economy approach from the very early stages across infrastructure, land use planning, precinct, and building design. And the first building in the precinct is now being designed and is under construction, and it includes amazing circular economy principles and strategies in practice. From a strategic point of view, this document is very important because we tried to set the project in the right direction from the early stages. The first very important shift has been not talking about just diversion from landfill, but talking about waste generation reduction targets, which means really understanding how much we are generating and how we can reduce that volume. Then we had pioneering options in terms of food organics infrastructure and looking at minimizing waste collection vehicles as much as possible to make this city as livable as possible for the future residents. And on top of that, there will be the establishment of a circular economy hub. The concept of a circular economy hub is very important because brings the whole idea of a circular economy back to people and communities and how we can really make a connection around learning new skills to repair materials and products and share them and foster a sense of community. And lastly, there has also been interesting conversation how we can implement last mile logistics within this precinct and looking at industrial symbiosis opportunity. So I would say this has been my favorite project that I've delivered last year. Another interesting project at master planning, but definitely smaller scale and also looking into building design has been the University of Tasmania, the Domain Campus, and the opportunity here was that most of the buildings were heritage listed, so there was a strong need to undertake an adaptive reuse approach to the existing assets, and we've gone beyond that, looking at opportunities for design for longevity, design for flexibility of the future educational spaces, but also looking at materials and product selection and identifying opportunities for leasing agreements and take-back schemes. What I really like about this slide is also the concept of the building by layer. So we know that looking at the built asset can be overwhelming. It's very complex, and we don't need to have a black or white approach. Rather, we do a perfect, fully disassemblable building, or we do nothing. We can really break it down by layer, look where the opportunities are, where the client and the design team and the budget sits, and identify strategy by strategy and layer by layer what can be done. So in the slide, there is a representation of what a preliminary screening could look like. And as I mentioned, all of that won't happen in silos. It's not one person doing this work, but it's really working with all disciplines, with the clients, with the builders, and with any contractor and demolition contractor on site. And it's really important establishing a collaborative approach to decide where, as a team, we want to go. And as was discussed in the previous session as well, talking about measuring circularity, it is very important. We also start to measure the circularity outcomes, both from a qualitative point of view and a quantitative perspective. And I've shared the two examples on the slide, and I just want to point out that embodied carbon is not the only important metric we can use. We can look at amount of materials saved. We can look at dollars saved from avoided waste disposal costs, and even considering how much water we are saving from not manufacturing a new product. I was shocked of the amount of water needed to manufacture a new tile of carpet. And just to finish up thinking at, where we want to head together, at WSP we're working closely with our indigenous team, looking at how we can apply an indigenous lens to circular design, what are the similarities and overlapping, because there's lots of synergies at the way we can look after country and look after our cities and trying to design future assets that are more sustainable. Thank you.
Thank you, Valentina. A great way, feel free to have a seat, by the way. A great way to kick off this afternoon. It is now time to welcome to the stage our wonderful panel of the rest of the speakers. As you hear your name, please come up and find a chair. We have Sophie Green, the Senior Circular Economy Consultant from Oricon Group, Lucy Marsland, Environmental Designer at Atelier, Rebecca Drake-Up, from New South Wales Sustainability Group Leader at Stantec, and Marcus Dorr, the CEO of MCI Carbon. And of course, our moderator for this session, Alexis Davison. And Alexis is the Executive Director of Engineering and Program Services at Major Road Projects Victoria, and has also been instrumental in establishing the Ecologic Program in Victoria. And if you haven't heard about Ecologic and the Recycled First work, I encourage you to do so. So please make them feel welcome, and over to you, Alexis.
As Emily said, my name's Alexis. I work at Major Road Projects Victoria. We do a lot of heavy lifting in the consumption of materials and the generation of waste. So my experience is particularly in the transport sector, but I think that the principles of circular economies are applicable across the building construction sector. And we've got an amazing panel with us today. I might just kick off by getting each of our panellists to just tell us why you're here, what your interest is in the circular economy, and I might start down the end and come this way. Rebecca?
Hi, so my name's Rebecca. I'm the Group Leader of Sustainability in the Built Environment team in New South Wales with Stantec. I'm an environmental engineer and economist by training. And I realised my sincere interest in circularity when I started an ethical clothing company and then later decided to close it down, when I realised there's already six generations worth of clothing in circulation, and I just couldn't be part of the problem anymore. So I wanted to find a way to still work within the circularity space, but obviously on a need that maybe was more focused in what we as a human race really need and require.
Thank you. I might skip you, Valentin. You've had a bit of a go, so maybe we'll...
Yeah. Hi, everyone. I'm Sophie Green. I'm a senior consultant in circular economy at Oricon. Oricon is a design, engineering and advisory firm. Our key markets that we work across are transport and infrastructure, water, energy, resources and buildings. I mean, I'm interested in the circular economy because I've always been into sustainability and started my journey in waste, which is now transformed into the circular economy. What do we do with all our waste? But in terms of the built environment, I mean, there's so much impact that we can have if we started doing this at scale, and that's why I wanted to work at Oricon and work in the built environment.
Thank you. Lucy?
My name's Lucy. I'm an environmental designer at Atelier 10. We focus on sustainable design of buildings and communities. And though my background is in structural engineering and construction, I now focus on integrating architects with their engineering teams who can talk more than they conventionally do, particularly on buildings projects across New South Wales and Victoria primarily.
Thank you. Marcus?
Thanks. My name is Marcus Dorr. I'm the CEO of MCI Carbon. We're a climate technology. And what we do is we transform CO2 emissions. We capture them. We stop them being emitted. And we put them through our process that creates materials for the circular economy. So these are new carbon-embodied materials that drive down the carbon intensity of those products themselves. So capture in the CO2 and also drive down intensity. So it's a double reduction. I started this 16 years ago when I exited a big company that I'd formed and found myself looking at a major solution to CO2. And 16 years later, we've got 50 people up in Newcastle. We're building our next plant, and I'll show you a little bit more about that when we talk through the process. But it's really important. We put our materials into cements and concretes, into flooring, into glass, into plasterboards. There's all these substituted opportunities for new carbon-embodied materials. It's a big game, and we do it with wastes like steel slags and ashes. We do it with raw materials, quarried rock from local quarries. So we're really focused on scale.
Thank you. When I think about building for circularity, I think about the system, and each of us has a role to play in the system, wherever you sit in the supply chain or the designers. Marcus, starting with you, what role do you think technology has to play in a circular system?
So a massive play, but it takes 20 years to develop a technology. And this is the unfortunate race we're in the race to net zero. So, 20 years ago is when you had to start. But these are now coming through. So the technologies need to play alongside, systems, alongside regulation. But to solve climate change and to get to circularity, we need good tech. But what's missing is finance. And we talked about that in the previous session. Yep. That is the big hole right now.
And Rebecca, you've done a lot of work in design and the fit out of buildings. What do you think?
So 80% of a defit ends up in landfill. And I've been really lucky to work with clients who have been excited about reducing that figure as much as possible, and also being able to bring that into their embodied carbon story and express embodied carbon savings too. So what we really love to see is, although people know what they're supposed to do, what the best practice method is supposed to be, it's just not being done. And so what that looks like is taking inventory. So you just need a stock take of everything in your fit out. And then it's about doing a preliminary life cycle analysis. So you can get a high level idea of which facets of your fit out might actually be the best places to focus your energy. And they're often not particularly interesting or shiny aspects. So we found that the access floor and the ductwork were the two biggest factors. If we could save all of that and keep it within the new fit out, then we would be saving sort of 10-15% of the embodied carbon of a whole new fit out. And an access floor, for those who aren't aware, is quite common in a lot of offices. It's basically just like a steel structure, which an entire sort of secondary floor is placed on. And then you're chasing your cables and infrastructure through that access floor. So it's a lot of metal, which, as we all know, has got high embodied carbon. And then in the ductwork, it's aluminium. Aluminium is the worst possible metal to have, basically. It consumes a high amount of energy to develop, even to recycle. And so simply being mindful of retaining as much of that as possible is another big saving, because, of course, typically all of that gets stripped out and your new design just gets plugged back in. So we really, really like to see that stock take, life cycle analysis, prioritisation approach, and that, you know, it's innovative, but it's also fairly simple. It's not, doesn't require extensive technology or anything to actually implement. And then the thoughts. So I know we've sort of touched on this before, but changing that thinking from requiring a product to requiring a service. And one example would be in a cold shell. There's often still ceiling tiles and light fittings. And what I understand is that the light fittings and the ceiling tiles, when the new tenant comes in, obviously they strip all that out and put their new stuff in, and those either go into landfill or they get stored in a basement somewhere, only to be brought out again when the tenancy has to change over. And so what I really want to do is challenge everyone here who might own a building or might be a builder working in buildings, is to offer a tender option where you're offering that cold shell fit out items, maybe as a rental or under a under that situation where the supplier will take back those items once they don't need it for the new tenant.
It's weird that something so simple has to be innovation.
Yeah,
it just sounds like a no-brainer. Lucy, you've had a lot of experience in designing precincts. How important is it to get the community involved in that design process?
It's critical because, I mean, kind of building on this, some of these solutions aren't technology based. They are about getting the right people,
yeah,
decision making to occur. And so whether that's Rebecca's example...
It seems quite simple.
Yeah.
We should be able to do that, right?
You've got to get the real estate agents, right, in the conversation and driving that. There's no sparkles to that. And I think for community at the precinct scale, for us, it's about, and I think Valentina could possibly also speak to this, how are you designing in that future circularity in operation? And that is physical spaces, the distance that... the vehicles are going to travel to pick up waste, having spaces and hubs within the community and getting that buy-in from the community that's going to be a positive for them, and that is social infrastructure, community infrastructure for them. And I think the New South Wales examples are probably the really strongest. So maybe there's some good case studies for the rest of us across Australia to see those examples play out.
Do you have anything to add, Valentina?
Yes, very much. The importance of having these social spaces where people can get together and understand what's the value, and sometimes can be very, very simple. You probably all know in New South Wales there is the very first tool library just started from one person who said, why we all need to buy a drill and we can't share those tools, and started very simply and can be very, very powerful. And we are hearing lots of interest from different councils and local governments looking also at, you know, the typical transfer station or community recycling centres, why we can just have that rather than having that as a place where the materials as waste is dropped, temporarily stored and taken somewhere else. Can we just add to those infrastructure and transform them in circular economy hubs where people can have a space to do a workshop, can repair something, pick up a bike? You know, I do a lot of, I call it the Verge shopping. I go around and get from the Verge. Why I need to do Verge shopping can just be a place where all the materials are just stored, catalogued, somebody can check it. It can be a good job opportunities for some people in need of a new opportunity and go from there, and can be very scalable. And I think a bit of a thread of today is about let's start small, start with something simple and build up from there.
Hmm. Sophie, you've got a lot of experience in designing and circularity. What do you think the gaps in knowledge and capability are in the industry, and where should we focus our attention to sort of start getting some of these simple ideas into actual action?
Yeah, so I think the maturity of the industry is different depending on the market. So I think in the transport and infrastructure space, there's been a lot of progress around recycled content, which I think is awesome, but I think in terms of adoption of circular design strategies, we're still at the very beginning of that journey. However, in the building sector, I think we're a lot more progressed. And just going back to some of the design strategies in the New South Wales Design Guidelines, which if you haven't read, I highly recommend you read. I use them all the time. They're amazing. We've done a lot of mapping with our clients around where the industry's at according to some of those strategies. So in terms of BAU or where reasonable expertise exists, I think we've seen a lot of progress around looking at reducing the operational carbon of buildings. So that's your low energy, high comfort buildings that are maybe powered by renewable energy. Green Star, Passive House have sort of driven a lot of that progress in that space. Diversion from landfill in terms of C&D waste, we've seen a lot of progress in that. Most organisations have quite high targets around that. And so I suppose that's an easy starting point. And then the other thing is, embedding operational waste management strategies into the design process. So, I mean, it's not always done. I know councils have a real bugbear around this in terms of multi-unit developments, but, the capabilities and capacities there. And then I think we're starting to see a lot more of progress around adaptive reuse and understanding the benefits of that from a sort of a carbon and sustainability and circular economy point of view. Where we're seeing probably an area where there's been trials and there's progress but maybe not existing at scale is around some of those design strategies, including dematerialization, so using less materials in the design process. Material choice substitution, again, great progress around some recycled content, but more, looking at the materials across the life cycle of a building, probably not as advanced. Standardisation and modularisation, procurement, we've started seeing the prioritisation of EPDs and LCAs into the procurement process. And then designing for longevity, durability, flexibility. And then the last one I'd say is utilising data for asset management. Where the real gaps exist, though, in terms of adoption of circular design strategies, I think design for future disassembly, we're still at the very beginning of that journey, I think, as a sector. Procuring products as a service, there has been some progress around some products, and this has to do with where the market is at in Australia. Carpet, air conditioning, those sort of more obvious ones. But as we sort of talked about, there's still a lot of opportunity to procure as a service across internal fit-out components. And then also the digital twin material passport aspect. So understanding our assets and the components of the assets, the materials and how they perform over the asset life. I think that's something that we really haven't sort of really, we're really starting that journey right now in Australia. Yeah.
Thank you. We've talked about getting actions, ideas to actions. I'm interested to talk about what role government policy can play in providing a catalyst for change. And from my own personal experience, the Recycled First policy has been a huge catalyst for change in the use of recycled content in transport particularly. Valentina, from New South Wales experience, what role do you think government policy can play, and should we have one everywhere?
Definitely policy can play a very important role as drivers. So the circular design guidelines, I think, are a great start, but I don't feel they have completed the journey. The gap we miss is still how each local council will embed those requirements, and similar to what we are seeing in the City of London or the City of Paris, looking at each council to include requirements for a circular economy in the built environment would be an amazing next step. And definitely it's a top-down approach, so starting from federal governments are working on it, and then ideally every state government will have their own guidelines, and I feel they don't need to reinvent the wheel, can definitely be based on other policies like the circular design guidelines, and then diving into local government requirements. And very important is also a key barrier I see and I hear on every project is at the construction phase. So the contractor and the demolition contractor, they really struggled, and looking at possibly changing in targets. So diversion from landfill is very important, but we really want to shift into monitoring how much we produce and how much we can avoid, and that will also shift.
And Rebecca, you talked about owners and operators of buildings. What's your experience with targets and incentives, and do they work? Do they not? Do they all have them?
Absolutely. Well, if you have a target, I think that most of the time you can make it happen these days. I guess you need to make sure that there's time and resources actually dedicated to it. There are, I think, some low-hanging fruit still in the sector. So, for example, make good clauses currently. They, you know, pretty much in every tenancy agreement, and they require the tenant to completely do a, you know, total strip back to how the fit out was originally, which was a bare bones. And what I'd really like to see is for that to be rewritten so that there's a clause in there requiring that the new tenant and the outgoing tenant are required to meet and decide what items can be left in situ between both of them. And I think that's, you know, it's just some low-hanging fruit still. I don't think it would cost too much, but there just needs to be a bit more thought, circularity thought, applied throughout the whole process of building operations, design, maintenance, everything, which we're still looking at. And if I could add one more, I've come across a community group out in Forest in rural Victoria. They've got a hall, but it's very reverberant, and they want to show movies in the hall, but they find the acoustics aren't great. And so they were kindly donated some amazing wool curtains by a cinema. They want to put them up, but the curtains don't come with a flammability test certificate. So what I would also like to suggest is, unfortunately, all the LGAs are in the other theatre, but if anyone knows someone from the COLAC LGA, would be maybe providing grants so that local community groups and SMEs have got access to testing facilities or can pay for tests so that they can reuse pre-loved items.
I think it's a great point that, like, we don't want red tape and process to get in the way of good things happening. Sophie, you've been involved in developing tools to measure impacts and outcomes.
Yeah.
How can we use those to sort of get past some of those barriers, whether they're perceived or real or red tape or bureaucracy?
Yeah. So the project, I suppose I'd just quickly touch on, was actually taking the design guidelines, again, that I am a massive fangirl of, and then we partnered with Life Cycles, another consultancy, to measure the potential carbon abatement of each one of those strategies. We also measured the potential for material and waste avoidance and then reuse and recyclability. So from each one of those strategies, we actually have an idea of sort of what is the most potentially impactful. I mean, the ones that scored highest were sort of around reusing existing assets and maintaining a materials database, and then design for longevity. But what we can take from that is that there is actually, like, we need to be able to prioritise the design strategies based on the impact. And there is a way to measure this, and that's the kind of data that we need to start incorporating into our storytelling, into the business case of buildings, or into the early concept design to help sell why building circularity is going to have impact. And so I suppose it's about, yeah, taking those, there's lots of different measurements out there and tools, and then being able to pull that together into a story and make that case as to why doing that innovation, which sometimes not even innovation, is going to have impact.
Mm. You look like you want to say something.
I want to make a case for the processes.
Go on.
Sometimes, you know, red tape. But
often,
this morning there was a bit of chat about preaching to the choir, you know.
Yeah.
And one way I find, and I'm sure others find, working on projects with specific teams to avoid preaching, because sometimes as sustainability consultants we can get in trouble for, preaching, is to go through a process with the architects, with the team, and it starts with, what have you got? You know, in the city of Melbourne, there's no undeveloped sites. Everything's a redevelopment. So there's no starting fresh, really, if you're in a metropolitan area. Measuring what you've got, and then let's go through the list.
Mm. Yep.
Mr. and Mrs. Architect, mostly Mr. Architect, you know, I've got some lovely plasterboard. Would you like to reuse that? No, it's pretty hard.
I think that's a good process. I think the kind of process I was being critical of is like not being able to get a permit to use something because of something.
But the process that educates and takes
on
the journey,
100%,
I think can be, it sticks with them.
Marcus, I think you've got some European examples of government policy or targets or incentives making a difference. Do you want to share one or two of those?
So one of our first investors is from Japan, so Toshio Corporation, and this year Mizuho Bank. And they're the third biggest economy in the world. People see China and America and basically Japan's next. They are well into recycling, well into circular economy, as we know. They've been advanced for 20 years, 30 years. And they've now legislated for basically their you know, zero carbon pathways. So all of their industries are looking for solutions now. And so we're now going with you know, what is a force of government, basically enabling the industries to take advantage. So recycling concrete is a big one, for example, but also getting rid of steel slags, making new materials. And I've got a negative carbon cement here that is a formulation with Taisei Constructions, one of their biggest construction groups. That's a negative carbon cement. So we're working with them on creating our materials to go into this to help do it on in larger scale.
Yeah.
And that's really, really essential. And also in Austria, where our first big customer is, RHI Magnesita, we're recycling and basically doing a circular economy play in refractories, high-temperature bricks. So rather than them heating up their magnesite, it lets off CO2. So it comes out of the rock. They can't get rid of it any other way. We capture it and we make that magnesite with another rock. And so it actually goes in a cycle. So, you know, millions of tons can be avoided in a circularity. And that's because the government initiatives and the standards, and this is another important side of it. All these materials, our substitutes, mm-hmm. need to be standardised. We're working with, you know, UTS in Sydney, Transport New South Wales, for example, around trying to find new construction materials for transport, for example. So government regulation is really, really important around standards.
Yeah. Don't forget to submit your questions if you have one. There's a question related to regulation and incentives. So the bottom line matters. So how do we measure and then communicate the benefits of lower embodied carbon to consumers and decision makers? Is regulation and incentive the only way forward?
So our big breakthrough is that we don't need a carbon price to make our materials. So our materials are profitable. So our challenge is just scale. So we can build a plant, a carbon plant next to an emitter, and if we've got the right feedstocks, you know, we have to have that right, and then we can have local markets, we can make it work. So that's a breakthrough for us. But government incentives, I mean, standards and language are very, very important globally. So we're all talking about the same things. And where this is going to hit the road is with the cross-border adjustment mechanisms around materials. And in circularity, it's the same. You know, can we ship or do we need to domestically deal with our own waste? I think that's what we're going to see globally is that we're going to stop the shipments of waste to other countries and we're going to have to deal with it ourselves.
Yeah. There's one I'll take as a comment, celebrating the diversity of the panel. We don't always see this much diversity, so congratulations to everyone for being diverse. We've talked about knowledge gaps a little bit earlier. Can the panellists comment on practical systems implemented in multi-unit developments to segregate food waste successfully? Rebecca, have you done this before?
Oh, I'm going to pass that to Martina, actually.
Yes, so food waste is definitely a challenge. And multi-unit developments have a big challenge in terms of food waste. City of Sydney has done some extensive trialing with opting and having a little kitchen caddy and find his way to manage that. The main challenge we have is that we know that food waste is heavy and unfortunately can smell pretty quickly. And in New South Wales, there is a requirement, for example, to mandate the collection of food waste potentially combined with organics. And we know that in multi-unit developments, the gathered organics is nearly zero. So there will be lots of issues on that. We have actually done a very interesting research study for the Northern Beaches Council, which has some multi-unit dwellings, but still a mix of walk-up up to three or four levels and some individual dwellings, and trying to understand what is the benefits of having a mixed approach. We might have, you know, some food waste bins collected for multi-unit developments. We might have still the old compost bin in your backyard, or linking back again to Circular Economy Hub, having a community garden for the whole, you know, suburb where you can actually meet somebody and have a chat and drop your food scraps, which is what I do because I'm not good at gardening, so I ask for some help. And from an innovation point of of you what we are trialing in two precincts, one in Victoria and one in New South Wales, is looking at a dedicated pipe and a dedicated infrastructure for food waste, mm-hmm. not mixing with waste sent to sewer, because that's all another elements of potential problems, but having a dedicated pipe that will go to a dedicated tank, and then it can be processed on site or taken off site as needed. Mm. But it's definitely a big challenge at the moment.
Yeah. Can I just add to that? Yes, I've done a bit of work in this space too, and I mean, just going back to the importance of design, I mean, I don't think there's a state in this country that has planning code that requires three waste streams to be separated and incorporated into the design of the building. That is a massive problem. Mm-hmm. Retrofitting buildings with new waste streams is a nightmare if you've ever tried to do it. So, I mean, the point is we need to start looking at the system, as we do with everything in the circular economy, and how early on decisions in building space and design actually have downstream outcomes, mm. not just for waste, but actually for well-being, for odour, and for you know, ultimately the residents. So I think it's a real gap in the system at the moment, and it's one that doesn't seem like many planning departments are keen to take on because it's quite complicated. Mm. Yeah.
I think too, when you're reliant on that collective sort of not contaminating the waste streams. I mean, I know I've lived in multi-unit developments before and you open the bin and it's like, ugh. So, you know, getting the stakeholders and community buy-in to why it's important is probably relevant to that as well.
Could I add another option as well? I'm sorry, sure. I forgot this one. It's not probably widely adaptable, but I do have the balcony worm farm at home and I love it because we don't have odours in the house. It just goes straight onto the balcony and then the worm droppings can go straight onto the gardens.
Thank you. What is the state of material passport and stakeholders' involvement in the construction industry? Do you have a view on material passports?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's...
From your perspective?
Mecla is a good example of a whole industry coming together focused on pathways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of, they're all about supply chains. And, you know, I think that's really what we need to be looking at is like right from, say, in our space, you know, John Holland, a borer, and then, you know, a builder, you know, in that supply chain. And they all need to be looking at, you know, how they coordinate around that. But we need demand, and we need demand signals, which is why, you know, Transport New South Wales, but also Department of Infrastructure federally, is now looking at demand signals to go into federal tenders when they, you know, co-invest with states to say, right, we want to put a target on, you know, recycled materials or carbon embodied materials or low carbon materials. Mm. And I think that kind of approach, tender specifications, like that is very, very important.
I think demand. In Victoria we've seen the Recycle First policy is generating
driving that. Driving it, yeah. Yeah, it's great.
Does anyone else have a view on material passports or...? There's plenty of other questions if you want to pass.
Yeah, no, I think that material passport, again, is can be as complicated as we want or can be very simple. So I think, again, sometimes because it gets too complicated in principle, we just give up. So starting very, very small and, like Rebecca was mentioning, as a fit-out, it starts with, you know, in this room, let's count how many chairs do we have, how many tables, and do we need anything more and what needs to be repaired, and having the first basic information, which is whether it's new or used, who is the manufacturer, what year has been produced, and what is the ongoing maintenance required, and making sure that all stakeholders are aware, because you don't want somebody else coming in fresh and throw everything away because they don't have access to that information. So I think it's definitely a powerful tool.
And maybe, Sophie, I'll start with you on this one. How do you weigh up the different environmental and social factors with material choices? You know, when you're advising your clients, like, circularity, embodied carbon, longevity, you know, there's a life cycle cost, there's a cost now, there's a cost later. Mm. How do you make those sort of choices and advise your clients on that delicate balance?
Well, I don't personally advise on material choices, so I can't speak to it. I don't know if anyone else can, but just in terms of like the decision-making framework in general, you know, there's got to be a process where you can prioritise according to what's important to the client. And so, yeah, we usually just come up with an assessment criteria. Cost is obviously one of them. you know, carbon, potential carbon abatement is usually one of them. But I think a really important part of that is shifting the cost structure from like the immediate cost to the cost across the life cycle of the project. And that's what we're not good at doing yet. And with that's a real shift that the industry has to go through. And as practitioners in the industry, we have to try start taking clients through that journey. I don't know if anyone else has got experience
Lucy,
on that.
Lucy, do you have a view on that? I think that a lot of the time these things aren't trade-offs, the social and the environmental or different attributes of a material. And a lot of the time, stacking up all the good reasons and taking a holistic approach, seeing ways that the different kind of themes of sustainability resonate with one another, generally is a way to not get things cost-managed out, right? If a decision you've made is ticking, you know, like building with, you know, timber, prefabricated timber, we do schools, New South Wales, kind of parts projects. It's ticking the box of biophilia, you've got revealed timber, it's ticking the low carbon box, and it's ticking the future reassembly or plug and play extensions box. So yeah. It's then really hard yeah. for them to value engineer that material out of the design if it's ticking a number of holistic sustainability attributes that align with the client's vision.
Yeah. And we've touched a little bit on this when we talked about the retrofit, but building demolition makes up the bulk of construction waste. So how do we encourage more waste recycling and reuse when construction projects have such tight delivery timeframes? Mm. If we didn't knock it down, we wouldn't need to get rid of the waste, right, Rebecca?
Correct. I feel like you should use this as an opportunity to plug Recycle First, though.
Well, you know, I mean, Recycle First is really about trying to attach value to waste streams. I think in transport infrastructure, we're pretty good at using construction and demolition waste. We're pretty good at reusing crushed concrete. And it's probably all the things on the inside that are harder to do something with than the concrete. You know, we crush that up and use it as rock. It's no problem.
Yeah.
It has a value, so...
I'd like to see people attach more value to things that have been used in the past and just apply some new paint or reupholster, and I think it adds as much value because a change is as good as a holiday. Yeah. It doesn't have to be brand new all the time.
Yeah.
I had a recent new experience, which was treating our demolition contractor as a consultant and actually bringing them in earlier on in the project and having a workshop where they are providing consulting expertise around reviewing the audit of the existing building and saying tricky, easy, you know, yes, no, the hot spots. And
what makes it tricky? Just how to dismantle it?
Mostly around the...
get it off intact? Or
yeah, that's right. So that's my plasterboard business. Yeah, and a lot of the questions from the client were, how long are these things going to take to disassemble? Because we know in Australia that labour costs are the greatest costs. So that's going through that process and taking everyone on that journey, I think is going to be a powerful way to harness the expertise of our demolition teams, which... I guess everyone kind of here knows.
That's where technology can help as well. So in Japan, they've got 60 million tonnes of concrete they need to recycle every year, and they can't do it all because it's contaminated. And there's technology we know that that one of the big cement groups has developed to basically get it right down to refined concrete. So it's fantastic.
There's a few questions about communal living and community gardens and not having theatres but having tool sheds instead. But given that there's 4 minutes and 8 seconds left, I'm going to finish on this question. If you had a magic wand, what would you do to accelerate the take-up of circularity in the built environment? Go, Rebecca.
Stock tape.
Magic wand, one thing.
I'd know everything, every item in every building.
Valentina?
I think I will put the key stakeholders in one room and lock the room and see if they agree on the next step. One step, and then you can leave.
Yeah. I would require every new building and refit and refurbishment to go through a circularity audit.
Yeah, I'm on the audit as well, and I want it in the planning. As Rebecca said.
Planning or even business case. Yeah.
So I want to accelerate to get our technology out there to scale to, you know, create millions, if not billions, of tonnes of material to replace those high carbon intensive materials. I do just want to bring my slide up, if I can, the next slide, to show you what our technology is. This is a global reference pilot plant. We run programs every day with customers all around the world. And the next slide, it's really, really important. This is what we're building right now. And this is 10,000 tonnes of material we're producing next year with this new plant. And that allows all of our customers around the world to get, you know, tonnes of material to then experiment with new formulations. And that's the game. I mean, you can't do kilograms. You need tonnes of materials for all of the producers, all our customers to be able to experiment with new carbon embodied materials and then test for circularity. That's a really, really
Marcus, important. Is there a number one application? Like, is it cement. Structural? It can go into structural columns.
Yep. So that's what we're testing right now is with UTS is doing performance testing. Around concrete applications, you know, ready mix and foundations. I mean, we can do pathways and all that kind of stuff. The other is plasterboard. So our other material is 50% by weight carbon emissions. So that's a massively carbon negative material. So, and it's a great substitute for gypsum, which is made from coal-fired power stations typically. So it's diminishing and they need a substitute. Magnesium carbonate is it. Fire retardant, it's lightweight, soundproof, and it's formable.
Great.
That's what we're working with the global leaders on that with. So, yeah.
I'd like to take an opportunity to thank everybody for their insights. Thank you for your questions. There's a couple that we didn't get to, but hopefully we covered the themes generally. Look, I'm kind of hopeful with people like this on the case that we can transition to a more circular world and it can be accelerated. And, you know, thanks to everyone for participating. Please thank the panel.